Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, February 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from CHP Berkshires, providing medical and dental care for patients of all ages in the Berkshires, plus women's health through the lifespan. CHP Mobile Health is on the road with same-day care for minor illness. CHPBerkshires.org. On this Medical Monday, we welcome Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology. Dr. Hurst is an interventional cardiologist and structural heart disease specialist. He's board certified in interventional cardiology, advanced heart failure, and transplant cardiology. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Colin Hurst and your cardiology questions coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and with us today is Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology. Dr. Hurst is an interventional cardiologist and structural heart disease specialist. His clinical role at St. Peter's Hospital includes a physician lead role in the structural heart disease program and physician champion of the cardiogenic shock and ECMO programs. If you have a cardiology question, give us a call today. 800-348-2551 is our number, 800-348-2551, if you have a question about your ticker. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Colin Hurst, welcome back. How have you been?
Ray, thanks so much for having me on. I've been well.
Good.
I've been well, yeah.
Hey, what's new over at the shop?
Well, you know, some exciting updates over at St. Peter's. It's been really a whirlwind of some news. We have gone through a couple of different changes, but, you know, I think that really what we're most excited about is the addition of a brand new cardiac intensive care unit that's coming our way. Should be operational within 1 to 2 years, or maybe, excuse me, 2 to 3 years. You know, and it really is going to provide us with a couple of advantages within the Capital District.
Now, how would a cardiac intensive care unit differ from a standard issue cardiac or intensive care unit?
Well, you know, as its namesake, really, it's designed to care for those patients who require intensive care. But really, the reason for intensive care is because of a cardiovascular condition.
But what gear? I mean, intensive care is intensive care, and if you don't have that cardiac unit yet, people presumably with cardiac issues go to intensive care. What new things are in this cardiac intensive care unit?
Well, it's a couple of different facets that I think that are going to, you know, really help to attract the best and the brightest, you know, to our hospital from nursing staff as well as physicians. You know, we're going to have a state-of-the-art facility, which is going to be completely newly renovated for some of the rooms that will be able to care for and monitor patients with some of the state-of-the-art technology that we use to monitor these patients' progress. We're also going to have a procedure room that's going to be within the unit. So basically, if there are patients that need some type of at-bedside procedure, we'll be able to facilitate that pretty quickly. And then additionally, it provides us with sort of a 360-degree multidisciplinary approach to some of these patients, you know, with some of the different features that we've added. And our hope is that some of these great resources is going to really attract, you know, some of the wonderful physicians that are in the community or, you know, at the sort of outskirts of the community to welcome them, you know, to our hospital, as well as some of the nursing staff that are looking to broaden some of their horizons and, you know, join St. Peter's or differentiate their role. So we're really excited about, you know, the advent of this new facility, which is going to open up probably about 2 to 3 years. And just so proud of everybody at St. Peter's Hospital for a lot of the work that was done in order to gain the funding for it and really set forth, you know, sort of a mission critical statement to identify the need.
So when you say it'll be in place in 2 years, 3 years, are you building another section of the hospital or will it just, are you pushing something aside?
No, not building another section of the hospital. We're actually going to be renovating an existing section of the hospital that's going to allow us to provide care for these patients. You know, and that's not to say that we don't have the ability to care for them now, but the center that we're going to renovate and improve is really going to be a state-of-the-art facility within the Capital Region to help with the care for these patients. It really broadens the catchment range for the hospital bringing in patients that may otherwise benefit from the care that are on the outskirts of the capital region, and welcoming them into our center so that we can end up using our specialized our expertise in order to care for them. And then additionally, using that as a leverage point for, you know, really the number one heart hospital that's in the Capital District. You know, if we're looking at our catchment range, I think that, you know, all the way south from Canada, west from Boston, east from Rochester, and north from New York City, you know, we're really the major medical center.
We're joined by Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology today. The number is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the calls and the emails, a couple things in your bio, you're going to have to define them for me. What exactly is cardiogenic shock? And why are you a physician champion? And what is a physician champion?
Yeah, you know, it's shock is sort of a status of really poor blood pressure and perfusion to all the vital organs. And it can be really something that one in two patients walking into the hospital with this type of problem may not make it out of the hospital.
So it's low blood pressure.
It's low blood pressure.
Okay.
It's low blood pressure. And that can be from a number of different cardiovascular complaints or insults. But the main point is to try to really get on top of these folks as quickly as possible and help to figure out what the underlying problem is and act on it. And so a lot of literature has been described about how an algorithmized or protocolized approach for these patients benefits them from increasing the time of when they come to the hospital, from the time that they come to the hospital to the time that they're discharged, that the survival and longevity of these patients improves with this type of approach. And this was an unmet need for our service line to try and create this algorithm and this protocol specific to our institution's capability and then also our community's needs. And so doing this, myself and many others that were deeply invested in this mission, were able to create this program. We've rolled this out, and we've really been able to help with making sure that there is an algorithmic checkbox approach to this type of insult when patients come into the hospital.
All right, Dr. Colin Hurst, you've used the word algorithm several times. Without getting too deeply into the weeds here, what's the data that you're plugging in? Who made this algorithm? Who is the maintainer of this, and who makes sure it's good data going in?
Great question, and to really simplify or sort of be succinct in how we sort of describe this, the algorithm is based on a lot of retrospective trials and data in our medical literature, and many centers have developed their own institutional protocols for caring for these patients, published those results, and we've taken the best parts of those different protocols from different institutions to personalize that approach for our patients in our community.
Okay, and you didn't really tell me what's going into this equation or algorithm, but I think I probably wouldn't understand anyway. But why isn't there so it's open source, but why isn't there one standard throughout the country?
A lot of different institutions have put out their best standard, but all of the resources for each of the hospitals are not the same, and the patient population coming into the hospitals may also not be the same.
So when you make this calculation, this algorithm, part of it is what you have and the facilities you have and the manpower that you have.
That's correct. We take into account what our resources are at home. So what do we do really well? And what are the things that we may not do as well as another center? Or potentially, who is it that we're treating in the community? And where are those folks coming from? You know, are they coming from different hospitals? Are they coming in through the emergency department? Are they coming in from our clinics? Or are they in the hospital and we just really need to make sure that we escalate their care more aggressively? And taking an inventory of all of those inputs, we then were able to really take the best parts of each of those algorithms that have been published with robust data to personalize our approach.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest today. It's 800-348-2551. We'll get to the phones in a moment. Cardiology today. You can also email the program voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Get to your questions. ordinarily, I don't allow Yankee fans in the studio, but Dr. Hurst is a Yankee fan. We're talking baseball here just briefly during the break. Oh, Zach Malloy's a Yankees fan, too. All right, that's fine, Zach. When you need your bypass, you'll talk to him. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Bill in Niskayuna writes in, you ready? It's a tad long. I'm 70 years of age, in excellent health, but have a strong family history of heart disease. Paternal great-grandfather died of a heart attack at age 54. Paternal grandfather died of a heart attack at age 53. Father had coronary artery bypass at age 48. Lived to 91, though. Over the past three decades, I've had multiple stress tests, echo stress tests, and sonography of carotid arteries. All were negative. My LDL is 76, HDL is 50. LPA is 83 nmol over L, nanomoles per liter, apparently, and blood pressure is 100 over 60. I have no diagnosis or symptoms of cardiovascular disease. My cardiologist recommended a nuclear stress test, which is the most appropriate stress test for me, nuclear or stress echo, and why? And before you say which is more appropriate, tell us how nuclear and stress echo tests work. Show's almost over by now, but right. Go ahead.
We typically have this annual gathering on the precipice of spring training, so I think that it was appropriate with the lead-in with Major League Baseball. But, you know, I think that this is sort of a two-part question. Bill, thanks so much for writing in. I know how much time and effort it takes, and so I really, really appreciate the input. To address your question, seems like the cardiologist with whom you follow is doing an excellent job at primary prevention. Your blood pressure, your cholesterol, from the description that you provided, is really excellently controlled. Now, in terms of the second question, in terms of stress testing, you know, typically we ask patients to undergo stress testing to evaluate new symptoms that may be thought to be ischemic, meaning that abnormal blood flow to the heart. And there's a couple of different ways that we can do that. Ray has just mentioned two of these different modalities. Those two different modalities accompany imaging. So we'll typically ask patients to exercise to the fullest capability, and if they're not able to exercise, we can simulate the effect physiologically of exercise with a medication. And so with a nuclear stress test, we give patients a radiopharmaceutical, and that is something where we can see that on a radioactive camera. It goes through all of the – we put it into the bloodstream, and wherever blood goes, that's where we can end up picking up the radiopharmaceutical. We ask patients to do some type of stress, either with chemicals, which is the drug that we can give them to simulate the effect of exercise, or have them get on a treadmill and exercise to the fullest extent of their capability. And typically, it's almost as if describing sort of a bottleneck that we would see in a traffic jam, where the more the demand or the more that heavy time of traffic, and then it only ends up going from four lanes down to one lane, you can expect that there's going to be some backlog. So patients that have areas of narrowed arteries or maybe even blocked arteries, when they begin to exercise, blood may not go to those areas quite as efficiently as if they had done this at rest.
Right.
And that's the concept of stress testing.
So the nuclear stress test, you are – how do you get the nuke in the blood?
It's a medication that they give intravenously.
Aha.
And that medication actually contains the radioactive material.
And what is that radioactive material?
Typically, it's technetium.
Technetium?
Technetium.
What's the half-life? Yeah. I mean, are you going to walk around radioactive for a while?
Yeah, so some patients, we do give patients a card, and that sometimes sets off certain types of things, particularly in government buildings. But don't be alarmed. You do get a card, and typically after about 1 to 2 days, it's not detectable.
Now, how many times in one's life can you safely have this nuclear stress test?
Well, you know, the cumulative effects of exposure to radiation, the more that someone's exposed to radiation, the more likely that you may observe some adverse effects to those, right? And that's been documented well in the medical literature that it's really neoplastic or cancer risk. But I can't give you sort of a hard number as to how many times that somebody can be exposed to a radioactive material. It may differ depending on somebody's, you know, own genetic makeup, how resilient that person is to, you know, the exposure to a radiopharmaceutical or radiation in general.
Did you say technetium?
Technetium.
So
technetium.
What's the atomic number of that one?
The atomic number, well, the radioactive, it's 99.
Oh, it's 99.
99, yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Now, regarding Bill's email, the stress echo is sort of the one we all have taken. You get on the treadmill and they...
Yeah, so the stress echo is just another imaging modality. So let's just say that that person may not be exposed to the radiopharmaceutical in the blood, or that, you know, there's they're looking for, you know, another type of abnormality on the imaging, you know, during exercise or during the simulation of exercise. Mm. And so we can use an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, to look at all of the different ways that the heart muscle moves and contracts, and using, you know, different multiple windows to look at the different regions of the heart muscle to come up with a conclusion as to whether or not there's areas of poor blood perfusion to the heart muscle.
I assume the nuclear stress test is A, more expensive, and B, is not the first one that you would say, oh, you got to take this. Why is it better, or is it better?
Well, I don't know if one is better than the other. It's one is looking for certain. It depends on what someone's medical history is, and then also what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And so it's what's the most appropriate test. That's how I would classify it. Is what's the most appropriate test based on the patient's properly heart structure and function, electrical system, as well as risk factors.
All right, final question on Bill's email, and then we'll move on. He said he was 70. His dad kicked the bucket at 54. His grandfather at, 43 or whatever it was. He's 70. He's in good health. Cholesterol's good. Obviously has seen a cardiologist for some time now. At what point do you call off the dogs and say, okay, listen, you're already X number of years old. You really probably don't need to worry about it. Something's going to get you now at any point.
Well, you know, I certainly think that, you know, for Bill, and we can talk about Bill and then also Bill as if you were a hypothetical patient, that the really strong primary prevention risk adjudication that the cardiologist has done, along with also probably the championing efforts of the primary care physician, really help to reduce overall risk.
Yeah.
And we look at someone's risk as about a 10-year. So what are some of the factors right now that if you were in 10 years to have some type of cumulative event? And those are stroke, mini stroke, unstable chest discomfort that may lead you to the hospital, heart attack, or even new onset heart failure. And so those types of cumulative events we plug into a risk calculator. We're not going to get so much into the risk calculator, but you know, certainly trying to drive down that overall 10-year risk is going to be something where we address patients' risk factors. Certainly, we can't do anything about someone's age, and certainly we can't do anything about someone's genetic history.
Yeah.
You know, sort of the heritage from their mother and
their
father.
How important is that?
It's important. It's important. So, you know, patients just, you know, by virtue of their genetic makeup, you know, may be at greater risk of developing heart disease. And you know, maybe that's just because of how, you know, cholesterol is made in their body as composed, you know, as compared to somebody, you know, without that genetic makeup that, you know, may predispose them to a higher level of cholesterol in the blood, for example.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest from Albany Associates in Cardiology. One more email for now, and then we got to hit the phones. Matthew in Rhinebeck writes, does the doctor recommend calcium scores, and are they useful?
This is a great question. Matthew, thanks for bringing this to everyone's attention, because this is really a good hot topic. And I can't tell you how many times that we have this question that comes up in the office, and I'm just so glad that you end up asking this question. So, you know, calcium scoring. Calcium scoring really helps as a secondary layer of risk adjudication. Typically, we use this in order to determine how much calcium, so hardening of the arteries that we can see in the heart vessels, so the coronary arteries. And we do this with a CT scan. And the CT scan basically is a static image. And that static image helps to quantify how much calcium is in the coronary arteries. And there's a linear relationship between how much calcium that we pick up and what the likelihood of some event, and those events that I previously mentioned, stroke, mini stroke, heart attack, probably unstable chest discomfort, new onset heart failure, how those types of events may affect somebody in 3 to 5 years. The more that you have, the more calcium, the more likely that that vascular bed, the coronary arteries, And atherosclerosis just doesn't stop at the coronary arteries. It happens in the brain. It happens in the kidney, also other vascular beds. So person would be certainly somebody to be at risk. So I find it very useful for some folks that may be on the borderline of whether or not to be aggressive with primary prevention. Typically, patients that have symptoms, calcium score probably wouldn't be the appropriate test, right? We're not using better or worse, right? You're more appropriate. Probably the appropriate test would be, in that case, a stress test.
Okay.
But a calcium score looks at someone's risk. And if we're saying, well, you know, the 10-year risk calculation, Ray, you know, sort of intermediate, maybe we could hold off.
Yeah.
But if the person has a really strong family history, or they're very concerned that, you know, other risk factors, for instance, a long time of smoking may predispose them to a higher risk than what we think is captured, then I think that, a calcium score really helps to, as a tiebreaker.
Okay.
Really.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest. Let's hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Mike is in Saratoga. Mike, go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Hurst. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Mike.
Actually, builds on the last two questions. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, it actually builds on the last two emails that you already addressed. So part of my question is addressed. Someone in their mid to upper 50s with strong family history, high calcium score, 500 plus, no other symptoms, nuclear test, stress test, everything normal, EKG, everything normal. Would you recommend any further diagnostics or, and then of course, cholesterol and blood pressure are under control. Would you recommend any further diagnostics?
Well, so, you know, we could sort of examine this question more from a hypothetical patient. You know, so if I were to see this patient in the office, you know, in the absence of symptoms, Mike, probably not. I think that I would just really have a risk-benefit conversation, you know, with this patient to look at what the overall risk is based on the calcium score, their 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular predicted risk, and then try and do as much as possible in terms of aggressive risk factor modification. So, you know, first and foremost, it comes down to dietary and lifestyle modification. You know, that should really be the foundation. Number two is really being aggressive with lipid control. Number three is making sure that tobacco cessation, if that is part of a patient's lifestyle, is addressed during the office visit. And then last is making sure that we do at least around 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week, where the American Heart Association has sort of supported at least about 150 minutes a week. And so really trying to end up taking some inventory about the risk factors and doing as much as we can for somebody who would be asymptomatic to drive down that patient's overall risk over the next 10 years would be what I would recommend.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Why 30 minutes 5 times a week? How did we arrive at that number?
You know, I think that really the concept is just, right, let's get out and move.
Right.
And if we can do that, you know, a half an hour. So what's a half an hour in your day? And if I think that if we can end up giving ourselves a half an hour of recreation time where we're active and we're moving, and we're doing that for 5 out of the 7 days a week, you know, that would really help to improve, you know, just sort of the things that we help to try to battle against, which would be sort of the endemic of obesity, also sedentarism, you know, and really some of the adverse effects of immobility, inflexibility, and a general sedentary lifestyle. I mean, think about, you know, sort of what our overall, you know, sort of how some of the jobs have sort of evolved here in the United States. We're more sedentary, less active. We're really behind computer desks.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, really the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology wants people to get up, move, walk around, and, you know, do whatever it is that we can in order to at least get a little bit of activity in.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest today. Let's go to Cahoes, and it's RK, your turn. Go ahead.
Dr. Hurst, good afternoon, sir. Dr. Graf, good afternoon, sir.
How are you doing?
So, have a little situation here. I have a cardiologist in my primary care, not at odds per se, but of differing opinions. So maybe we're looking for a tiebreaker today.
And RK, are you asking me to be that tiebreaker?
Well, you or Dr. Graf.
All right, listen, I'm going to be the bookie. I'll place the bet on what he's going to say.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay. Real quick background. 46. Very strong family history. Father passed away at 43 from coronary artery disease. Most of my biomarkers are very good, except for my LDL, which came in at 200. HDL came in at, 85. That prompted a calcium CT scan. That came back zero. Now, Ray, after that,
yeah,
I went over to Rocco's and had a large pie.
Oh, boy. Celebrate. That'll drive it up. Good for you.
After the results came in, cardiologist called and said, hey, see you in a year. You're good to go. Primary care doctor, on the other hand, is strongly, very strongly advising starting a cholesterol-lowering medication. So that is kind of where I am right now as to, okay, I'm 46. There's no calcium. However, as you know, that doesn't mean there's not a three-alarm fire, right, in my arteries. So I'm kind of torn. You know, do I just say, okay, I'll go back to the cardiologist in a year. Maybe we'll do a cholesterol, panel, a lipid panel, and see where we are. Or do I say, hey, you know what, let's get on this now and do the intervention now.
Of course, just before he answers, RK, he hasn't really seen you as a patient. So what if he gives you the wrong advice here? He really can't diagnose over the phone. He could make an inspired guess, but, I mean, Jesus, should you follow that? I don't know.
Ray, that's a good point. So
that is a great point. I will take anything said today under serious advisement.
That's good. That's good.
Okay. All right. With that.
Okay.
Right, with that release of liability, we can proceed. Sorry. Thanks, guys, for that lighthearted moment. But, in all seriousness, I think that, one of the things that I would end up encouraging, and whenever we end up having this, type of polemic that's in the office, I typically don't have any problem with picking up the phone and calling my colleague. We're all in this together to try to make sure that we keep folks like yourself safe. So, if we're trying to come up with a diagnostic plan, first and foremost, in person or over the telephone, closed loop communication really is the standard. I think that the second thing that I would sort of say is, undeniably, if somebody that is your primary first degree relative has had a significant event, for instance, like early cardiac death because of potentially a myocardial infarction, heart attack, at age 43, and you're sort of, within the 40 to 45 range, and your LDL is, 200, we're talking about potentially, is this a genetic or heritable cause of an abnormal cholesterol? And that would be something that I would end up entertaining as a diagnosis. But, maybe the tiebreaker between your cardiologist as well as the primary care physician, because I think that your primary care physician may be onto something, would be potentially looking at a lipid subclass. So the cholesterol is divided up into four parts in a traditional cholesterol panel, and the LDL is actually calculated from the three other parts that are measured: total cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein, so HDL, and then your triglycerides. And sometimes the LDL can be sort of erroneously reported if your triglycerides are very high. Doesn't seem like it. That's in this case. But what I would say is that there's a lot of emerging data that those patients who have a normal lipid profile but have a very high lipoprotein little a, which is basically a subclass of some of the smaller, the low-density lipoprotein, which is your LDL or lousy cholesterol, that those patients may be at a greater risk for cardiovascular events. So it may be helpful to have a discussion with both of them as to would it be helpful in this situation that this biochemical test may serve as my tiebreaker? Hopefully that helps.
Did you understand any of that, RK?
I have, because I've listened to perhaps hundreds of hours of podcasts with cardiologists. I feel that. Now, I don't know if that makes me a good patient or a bad patient, because I go into these situations with maybe too much knowledge. I mean, is that possible, doctor? I mean, there's such a wealth of knowledge out there, but it's all conflicting.
I love this point, RK.
I
That's a whole show. I love it.
One cardiologist, yeah. Yep. They'll say, hey, you know what? Don't worry about LDL. It's all based on this Framingham study, right? That's ancient science. Forget it. And then you have other cardiologists say, oh, my God, the LDL is 200. You're going to be dead, right? And it's like, okay, well, how do you parse it for what's best for you? And I know I'm going way off.
Yeah, you know what? You sound brilliant to me, but we have 30 seconds before the break. So let's let the doc answer. RK, very good work. All right, doc, what do you think?
You know, just to be very, very brief and succinct here, I think that, you know, there's an innumerable amount of literature that shows that the lower the LDL, the lower that your overall incidence of some type of adverse cardiovascular event rate is. So the likelihood that if you drive down your LDL, your risk also correlates to that. The second part is that I think that, you know, as Ray mentioned, it can be an entire show in and of itself about the informed patient. I think that anybody that comes into my office, I welcome them with open arms if they have, you know, some context, they come prepared with questions, and they've done some of their own research. It's a collaborative venture, and I think that, you know, patient-physician cooperation is, you know, sort of a along with communication, sort of those are hallmarks of a good relationship.
All right, RK, we got to roll here. It's break time. 800-348-2551. Dr. Colin Hurst from Albany Associates in Cardiology joins us. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's cardiology today on this Medical Monday with Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology. Before we get to the next call and then some emails, we talked about cholesterol meds just now when RK was on. Is there, and you mentioned that your lower LDLs seems to indicate that you will potentially have a better time down the road, but is there strong statistical evidence that cholesterol-lowering meds lower the risk of cardiac events?
Yes.
Is this new?
No.
Really? Because I remember seeing ads for many of these cholesterol meds that said, bottom of it, not been shown to have an influence or affect your risk of heart attack. So now we have data that says, yes, that's the case.
Yes, the data are pretty strong over a number of different years when we're looking at secondary prevention.
Yeah. Does it actually lower your cholesterol?
So, yeah. So the way that some of these medications work in terms of the statin therapy medications,
yeah,
it blocks the body's ability to make cholesterol in the liver.
But that stops making new cholesterol, but does it lower your overall numbers?
So cholesterol comes from two different sources. Cholesterol comes from what you eat and then also what your body makes. Cholesterol can be the backbone of a lot of different number of different things in your body, potentially, for instance, steroid hormones, you know, and that's the signaling pathway for a number of different organ systems. But cholesterol, the main enzyme is the rate-limiting enzyme for cholesterol synthesis. That's what statins target. Mm. There's other medications that block cholesterol from being taken up by the gut. And then there are other medications, the newer ones to the block, are ones that really decrease the degradation of the receptor that pulls cholesterol into the liver to be metabolized.
Huh.
So if you have some type of receptor on the liver and that is always pulling cholesterol out of the blood, your cholesterol levels will be very low. Because the liver is continuously sucking up that cholesterol from the blood, and then it's metabolized in the liver cell.
There are no meds currently that will reduce the hardening, the calcium?
So the hardening and the calcium that we see is that's really the metabolism of the cholesterol that's in between the different layers of the artery. And without going too deep into the weeds, when that process happens, those particles of cholesterol become hardened and calcified. So that really is the end stage of the cholesterol metabolism in the little different walls of the arteries. Mm. So when we're looking at whether or not that's something that can be found in a, for instance, a diagnostic test, you know, to help us give us a sense about how much of this is inside of the walls of the artery, that's what we're looking for. Doesn't really particularly pick up soft plaque, but can I get a lot of questions about, do these cholesterol medications potentially slow the progression or even reverse that?
And so, what's the answer?
So doesn't reverse the hardening. So once it's been calcified, that's sort of the end result.
So you can't soften them up again.
But no, you can't reverse the calcium process. But what you can do is, if there is softer cholesterol before it's hardened and metabolized in that way, it can be taken back up into the bloodstream. And our goal these types of drugs is to really lower that overall cholesterol burden.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest today from Albany Associates in Cardiology. Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
What are the largest and smallest diameters of the catheters used in interventional cardiology?
Interesting.
Jim, thanks for your question. That's a pretty specific question, but, you know, I'll do my best here.
Okay.
So the diagnostic catheters that we use, it's all on a French size, and a French is 0.3 millimeters. So the catheter size that we use in our laboratory for diagnostic procedures is 5 French. So that's less than 2 millimeters in diameter. And we can use catheters to perform interventions all the way up to about 8 French when we're talking about, you know, interventions for the coronary arteries.
8 French.
Yep. And we're talking.
Shouldn't you call it Freedom?
That is right around just less than about 3 millimeters. But we can use catheters in different parts of the body for different reasons when we're accessing different blood vessels. And, you know, we can get those all the way up to about 20 French, 25 French. And there's been some for certain structural heart interventions all the way up to 30 French. But that's sort of beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today.
Boy, I'll tell you what, you're right about that. Thanks for the call, Jim. Let's go to Rob and Otis. Rob, you're on with Dr. Colin Hurst.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This morning I was swimming laps, pool, the Olympic-sized pool, and according to my watch, my average heart rate was 159 and my max heart rate was 190. And then I've got the heart rate zone, VO2 max, was 131/146. And my age is 75. So I just want to know if it's something I have to worry about.
Rob, thanks so much for your question. You know, and we've been really blessed with technology to provide us with a lot of insight. And that technology sometimes also provides us with an abundance of information, almost an inundation of information, if you would say. So in terms of the question that you're asking about your heart rate, the fidelity of some of these technology pieces that we wear has been increasingly improved. And so if it says 190, you know, you can probably think that, you know, that's a little bit abnormal. And we'll go, and the reason why I say that is because your maximum heart rate is dependent upon your age. And so you appropriately identified your age.
Right.
So it's 220 beats per minute, and you subtract your age from that. So yours is probably around 150. But if it gets all the way up to about 190, that's way beyond the threshold of what we would think as normal for an exercise response, you know, for your age alone. So does that represent either an abnormal heart rhythm versus an erroneous reading on your watch? You know, hard for me to say over the radio. But I think that certainly that would be a point of discussion that you would want to have with either your general practitioner or with, you know, one of the consulting cardiologists. Yeah.
Yeah, I did mention it to him last summer because I was pond swimming. Didn't know if it had something to do with the cold. It was a similar heart rate then. But then the next day after I got that information, I hiked up the ski mountain, and at a really fast pace, and my heart rate was normal. was in the normal range. I don't remember exactly what it was, but
okay.
Well, Rob, I'll tell you. I think that you, at your age, with your description of your cardiovascular fitness, is aspirational.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to come over and mow my lawn.
I hope that when I'm your age, that I am able to briskly hike up a ski mountain and then also do pond swimming.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Rob, thanks a lot. We're going to let you go there. Here's a good question from Mary. Does taking a calcium dietary supplement increase a person's risk for heart issues? Mary is 62 years old.
That is a great question, because oftentimes we have that question that comes up in clinic. Mary, thank you. Just briefly, a dietary supplemental calcium, you know, typically is not going to be associated with increasing the calcium burden that you would see deposited elsewhere that may affect outcomes. You know, the calcium is sort of a reflection of the metabolism of lipid in different parts of the body vulnerable to that, to atherosclerosis. Calcium supplementation in typically, you know, patients, women postmenopausal, is really to help prevent osteopenia, weakening of the bones, or osteoporosis, really, you know, porosity or holes within the bones.
I mean, bearing in mind that most everything that we take medicine-wise and really anything is a cost-benefit analysis, right? So taking that, if you're getting older and you're postmenopausal and this is a real concern, is all right in general?
Right, yeah. I mean, I think that any medication, you know, as a therapy, as you mentioned, it's a risk-benefit ratio analysis.
Yeah.
You know, that should align with the patient's goals of care. And, you know, we like to have those conversations in the office, and I spend a lot of time with folks. You know, but to answer your question, I think that, you know, really, what is the one thing that's going to end up being, what is the one thing that's going to be the greatest risk? And I think that, you know, bone strength and health is important, you know, as well as cardiovascular risk adjudication. But
yeah.
You know, thinking about sort of the immediate, you know, sort of the short, you know, long term, and then the long term, you know. And so I think that having a discussion with your primary care physician as well as with your, you know, other consulting subspecialists, you know, helps to give us sort of goals of care as to how we would want to proceed.
All right. One more email and then we'll go back to the phones here.
Great.
As we wrap it up with Dr. Colin Hurst. This is from Maria, wondering if it's possible for someone with CHF, so that's congestive heart failure?
Congestive heart failure.
To improve their situation, such as improve their ejection fraction with exercise?
That's a good question. I'll first start off by saying that really the main therapy for heart failure is making sure that we get a good baseline assessment. The medications that we have now available to us are just remarkable. And that is really the foundation of our treatment. We also want to make sure that we do a good assessment of what someone's functional status is. There's some patients that may not be that functional to tolerate exercise, but certainly trying to get them on medications may help to improve their exercise tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So the foundation should be good baseline assessment, getting on the appropriate guideline-directed medical therapy, and then, you know, as exercise is tolerated, integrating that into the patient's personalized plan of care.
Dr. Colin Hurst is with us. Let's grab a couple few more calls here before we wrap it, and we'll go to Albany and Guinevere. You're on.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My mother just came out of the emergency room. She had two mini strokes, which we didn't know the first one happened. But she's sent home now. She has atrial fibrillation, and she has aortic valve stenosis. And we do have, from the neurologist, a script for OT and PT, but we haven't seen a cardiologist outside yet. And I just wondering, should she be going for some cardiac rehab or like a stress test like you're talking about to see if she can tolerate certain exercises before she, I mean, I want her to gain her gait, her balance back and strength back, because she's completely out of breath with everything and very weak. But I was just wondering which the right, you know, the right order in which we should
okay.
do things.
Yeah, great couple of questions. And first, I just wanted to make sure, you know, that I hope and wish that your mom has a nice and speedy recovery. So those thoughts are, you know, from our radio station to you and your family. Second is that I think that it's important for us to sort of take a look and just sort of take a look at, you know, sort of the forest from the trees here. You know, taking a step back, she's got a couple of different issues. You know, atrial fibrillation is certainly a large risk factor that probably, you know, should be accounted for when talking about the stroke. That in and of itself puts patients at risk for stroke. And second, as well, the aortic valve narrowing. You mentioned aortic valve stenosis, but for everybody else on the line that may not be familiar with the terminology, stenosis just means and refers to narrowing of either a blood vessel or of a valve. And so she's got aortic valve narrowing, and sometimes when those aortic valve leaflets become hard, thickened, immobile, and calcified, you know, parts of that can break off, and that can also end up leading to stroke. So a lot of different things that potentially could have caused her stroke that should also be evaluated, you know, by a cardiologist. I think that really it's important to have her follow up with somebody outside of the hospital for her cardiac care. And we at the Albany Associates in Cardiology, we'd be happy to do that if there is not somebody that with whom she currently follows. Second is that in terms of occupational therapy and physical therapy, certainly that would be a mainstay of the therapy included in the comprehensive plan care for stroke rehabilitation. So hopefully that helps to order things. But in terms of what's the order, I think that probably just making sure that you have, you know, somebody from a cardiac standpoint helping to quarterback the care, and then we can move forward with making sure that, you know, she ends up, you know, continuing with the physical therapy and occupational therapy.
Guinevere, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. All right, Dr. Hurst, we only have about 45 seconds here, and a couple quick questions. We're not going to get to Jim. He's 84. How do you quantify 30 minutes of exercise for someone his age? That's a little tricky, yeah?
Yeah, you know, simply just do whatever it is that you can within that 30 minutes of activity. And if you feel like you're breaking a sweat, or if you feel like you are, you know, doing as much as you can, then that your body's telling you some feedback. That's where I would stop.
So if I break a sweat getting to the car in the morning, I'm pretty good to go. That's exercise.
I don't know. I think that you could push it probably a little bit further,
but possibly. But let's not go crazy here, Dr. Hurst. All right, last one here, and then we'll wrap it. What are the negatives of using statins? That's from JW, and we only have a few seconds.
Sure. Couple of different things. It depends on different subclasses of the statin therapies, but some have been mentioned in increasing glucose intolerance. Some have been mentioned with abnormal lipid function, liver function testing. But really, the mainstay is sometimes patients, 10% of them, really do complain of muscle aches and weaknesses. So after starting one of those medications, if that happens, please notify your doctor.
CoQ10. That works. That helps.
Yeah, potentially.
All right. Dr. Colin Hurst, you know, I wish you good luck on your Yankees. I think it's going to be okay.
Thank
Subway
you.
Series, thank perhaps.
Maybe. If we as New Yorkers are so lucky.
Aren't we? And all those listeners in Massachusetts are annoyed right now. All right, man. Hey, thanks a lot for being here. We'll see you next time.
Hey, great. Thanks so much for the invitation. I love being on, so
well,
thank you.
We'll see you again soon. Support all comes right, from Berkshire
care.
Community Action Council, now accepting fuel assistance applications to assist with home heating costs online. To apply, .org/BCAC. That's it for today. Thanks again to Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology for joining us. Thank you for the calls. Thank you for the emails. Thanks to Bob Rathbun, who screened the calls today. Well done, sir. Zach Malloy, our engineer. And I'm Ray Graff. Okay, tomorrow, it's exciting stuff. It's Birding with Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. We'll talk about the birds. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.